accession number 20496, reel 4.
Edwin Drew, reel 3.
The situation the next day, as I've just been saying, was a revelation in one way, I suppose. None of us had had any experience like this before, and the conditions, the sea conditions, were reasonable. We hadn't seen anything of Dorsetshire's survivors at all. We knew nothing about them. And we did our best to protect ourselves from the sun as it came up by using clothing that we were wearing. As far as the engineers were concerned, we had boiler suits on, so there was plenty of spare material that we could tear off to use to cover our heads from the sun. I think it was then that Archbold, my engineer mate, he took his trousers off and to tear off the legs to put over his head, threw the trousers away over the side, and then about half an hour later there was a tremendous shout from Archie to the effect that he'd thrown his trousers away with the £50 in his pocket, that he'd risked his life in a way to go down below when the ship was sinking. He never forgot that, even to the day he died. He never forgot that. And of course, to some of us, it was rather amusing. And the doctor aboard the ship had changed all the rations aboard the lifeboats, etc., and Carly floats, from biscuits and water to crates of tinned fruit. And this was marvellous, really, because the tins were passed around, and these were all in the motorboat, fortunately, which had floated off and was acting as the headquarter ship for our little congregation of Carly floats. The tin of fruit would be handed round with a punctured lid, and we'd all take a swig of juice and pass it on. And then when that tin was passed back to the motorboat, it would be then opened later, and the fruit was used in order to slake our thirst. Sometime that morning, we actually did see a plane. It wasn't near at hand. It didn't come near us. We didn't know whether it was from the fleet, our own fleet, or whether it was from the Japanese fleet. But at least it was a plane from one of the two fleets, because we were some 750 miles south of Colombo. This raised everybody's hopes, and in due time, at about 7 o'clock in the evening, just as it was getting dusk, and dusk night falls very quickly on the equator, ships were seen, and of course everybody's was out of their mind, very nearly, with relief. And it was two destroyers and a cruiser. The cruiser was Enterprise, and the two destroyers were Paladin and Panther. Afterwards, we were told that Admiral Somerville had received the report from the aircraft that we had seen, and he had detached this small contingent from the fleet in order to search the area for half an hour and pick us up if we were found. If we were not found, then the ships would return to the fleet, because at that time the fleet was at action stations, and action with the Japanese could take place at any time. This was not the first time I learnt afterwards that Admiral Somerville had gone back or taken a decision to go back into danger in order to pick up men of who had been sunk or were damaged ships. And it needed a tremendous willpower and authority to take such a step in dangerous conditions. However, he was known as Uncle James, and we thank God for Uncle James on that particular occasion. We were picked up in various ships, in various boats rather, and towed. The Carly floats were towed by ship's motorboat to the Enterprise, who were scrambling nets down the side of the ship, which we all thought we would be able to climb up, but after 29 hours in the water, we found that we had virtually no strength at all, and we needed every assistance to get aboard. Photographs appeared in the press at home in due time, and it was an amazing sight when you looked at the photographs in retrospect. We were taken aboard, and as far as I was concerned, it was I knew an officer aboard Enterprise. He'd been one of the new entries which had joined President in October 1937 with me, and we had met subsequently in Colombo shortly before we were sunk, and I was able to meet up with him again, and I had a wonderful sleep in his cabin after I'd been cleaned up by a marine, as we all were. We were all still covered with heavy fuel oil, and it was a relief to get clean. Our nervous state was absolutely horrendous. Our nerves were just like violin strings. And we were taken, the ships returned to the fleet, and the next morning, after I woke up, the first thing that I heard was gunfire, and I reacted badly, I suppose, but that was because of my nervous situation, and only to be reassured by the Marine servant that it was only a practice high-angle shoot by the fleet. Which didn't do survivors any good at all, but as far as we were concerned, that was it. We didn't know where we were off to. We were all steaming as a fleet, and eventually we arrived at Adu Atoll in the southern tip of the Maldives. Let me start again on that one. Adu Atoll was very similar, and I think I've already referred to it, to Scapa Flow, a large area of water surrounded by coral islands and a large fleet anchorage. As soon as we arrived, we were in Addu. The survivors were split up into sheep and goats, so to speak, and those that were wounded were transferred to hospital ships, and those who were not wounded were transferred to other ships of the fleet. I was transferred to the Renown, I beg your pardon, to the Revenge, one of the old R-class battleships, and we were kitted up there to the best of the ship's ability, and which you can imagine was pretty difficult when a ship, even though a battleship receives a large number of survivors, and I can't remember how many survivors there were sent to Revenge, but anyway, they made terrific efforts on our behalf, and we were all kitted out somehow. And at that time I smoked a pipe, and even one of the officers gave me a new pipe, which I was very grateful to have. The next thing that happened was we left Addu and steamed independently to the west. We didn't know where we were going, but we couldn't go east, so we were going west, and in due time we arrived at Mombasa. That trip from Addu to Mombasa needs to be talked about. The ship mechanically was in a disaster area. She had more than 50% of her boilers were out of action, and we were steaming at something very slow speed. We were only allowed about a pint of water, drinking purposes, because of the need for every drop of evaporated water for use in leaking boilers. We washed in seawater, and if the population of the country had known the situation that some of the country's old ships were, the condition they were in mechanically, it would have caused a lot of unrest, I'm sure. However, we got to Mombasa, and we were transferred to a troop ship called the Mendoza, and which already had a large contingent of Polish servicemen who had been prisoners of war in Russia as the result of the Russian advance across Europe at the time that Russia had been in union with Hitler, and these Polish prisoners had been stationed in Siberia. As soon as the breakup between Hitler and Russia occurred, then of course the Russians were anxious to get rid of their Polish prisoners, and they came down through the Middle East and were sent home on troop ships as quickly as possible. Mendoza had something like 100, I suppose, Polish servicemen aboard. in addition to the Polish servicemen, we had a lot of senior officers from the British Army, from the Western Desert, whom we were informed, unofficially of course, had been thrown out by Montgomery, who'd taken over command of the forces in the Western Desert, as not being sufficiently fit or capable of running 5 miles a day, and a lot of presumably senior officers who'd been called back at the beginning of the war were returned to the UK. We came down in the Mendoza, unescorted, down the east coast of Africa to Durban, and that wasn't a very a pleasant experience for us, because we knew that Japanese submarines were operating, especially around the Mozambique Channel between Africa and Madagascar. Anyway, we got to Durban, and which was nearly like home to us, because we'd been operating out of Durban for so many months, and we all had friends there. And so that was a tremendous help to our nerves. And we were there for some fortnight or 3 weeks. And what we didn't know, and what we were all concerned about at that time, was whether we would be returned to the UK, or whether we would be dispersed to various ships in the area for further service. Two or three of our officers of the ship were sent off to back to Colombo to pick up appointments in the Repulse or Prince of Wales, which were subsequently lost. We then picked up a troop ship from Durban to Cape Town, the Empress of Russia, and again we arrived at Cape Town, and we were put into the camp and awaiting transport home. Eventually, and I can't remember how long we were in Cape Town, but I would imagine it'd be something like a fortnight, we were put aboard a troop ship called the Bergensfjord, a Norwegian ship, passenger ship of some considerable age, and we then left Cape Town. We expected to be pick up a convoy, but we steamed off on our own, and we came home all the way unescorted in June 1942, at a time when the U-boat offensive was at its greatest. We were in no state whatsoever nervous, from a nervous point of view. Again, we were entertained every night by the Polish servicemen who'd formed themselves into a choir, and they gave some wonderful concerts every night. Sometimes they repeated themselves, but generally speaking, they seemed to be able to produce new programs every time. As soon as the bar opened, I'm afraid we took as much Dutch courage as we could, and there was only one incident when we were the alarm bells rang, and it appears that it was a table with upturned legs, which somebody had spotted and thought was a U-boat periscope. But apart from that, we came home safely and eventually landed at Glasgow. And two things I think one should I should end up with on that. And the ship had a wind-up gramophone. The Bergensfield had a wind-up gramophone and one record. And that one record had Sleepy Lagoon on one side and on the reverse, Yes, My Darling Daughter. And that one record was played and played and played in the journey home from Cape Town to Glasgow. I should say, of course, that we called in at Freetown to fuel on our way home. And the second point that is worthy was that as we steamed up the Clyde, in the early morning, it was the first time we had seen the land of the UK for some 18 months, 2 years, whatever it was, something like that. A Scot was walking up and down on the deck of the ship, singing Scottish songs at the top of his voice, and that was really was an indication that we were home. He was absolutely giving vent to his nervous reaction and saying how pleased he was, and this went for all of us. We were delighted to be home.
Had the Scotchman been in Cornwall?
No, he was one of the officers who was returning. Not an old and bold, I would have hastened to say. He was quite a young man, but I think that's the story of the Cornwall, as far as I can remember, after 60 years. And I hope it may be of use for somebody in later years to listen to, however.
Certainly will be, but what happened to you? Can you take me through the rest of the war, step by step, please, as far as it affected you?
Well, I returned home from Glasgow, and I arrived home by the night overnight train from Glasgow. And when I got home, I saw my first son, whom I hadn't seen. He was aged 11 months, and he wasn't at all happy about having another man in the house, and it took some time to overcome that. But I then had to report, of course, to the Admiralty, which was the particular office for engineer officer appointments, was in a block of flats which was called Queen Anne's Mansions, which stood on the site of the present Home Office in at the bottom of Tothill Street, Westminster. And I remember going in there and talking to the commandery who was in charge of appointments. And he said, right, he said, we're going to appoint you to a new cruiser which is building and is nearing completion in John Brown's yard up in Glasgow, and you will join her in 3 weeks' time. Full stop. In those days, there was no suggestion of counselling or assisting officers who'd been in action in extreme conditions or anything. You were just given 3 weeks leave, and you were back into... I was fortunate insofar as that I joined Bermuda, HMS Bermuda, in John Brown's yard on Clyde Bank. I think it was in July 42, and within about a month, she was commissioned and proceeded on trials and eventually ended up at Scapa.
What kind of ship was this?
I beg your pardon?
What kind of ship was this?
Oh, this was an 8,000-ton cruiser of the Fiji class, colony class ship. She was a modern ship, had radar, which of course Cornwall didn't have, modern guns, modern gunnery programs, and so you at least felt that you had a reasonable chance of putting up a good show in action. I spent 2 years in Bermuda, and during that time we, from seagoing point of view, we spent our time acting as ocean escort to the convoys proceeding to Murmansk. And in 42, of course, we only took convoys up in midwinter when the darkness provided protection. The convoys were provided with close escorts of destroyers, frigates, and deep-sea trawlers, converted trawlers. And then, because of the heavy ships which the Germans had in Altenfjord at the north of Norway, the convoy had protection by a group of three cruisers which just steamed between the convoy at a distance of some 50 or 100 miles between the convoy and the Norwegian coast. There were two teams of cruisers, and there was Belfast, Sheffield, and Norfolk, I think, were in one team. And the other team were Bermuda, Jamaica, and another county-class cruiser. I can't remember the name. And we used to take it in turns. One team would go up and come back, and the next convoy that went up would be our turn. And as the availability of convoy escorts became improved and more ships became available, of course the convoys to Murmansk started to run throughout the year, summer and winter. And eventually, of course, the Germans were forced into taking action, and this led to the Scharnhorst sinking. And at a time when it was the other team of cruisers who were covering the convoy,